welcome to everyone who's tuned into the Psychology Is podcast. I'm introducing Dr. Roger McPhillan to you. You may already know about him, and today we're all going to get to know him better. So, Roger, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
I was mentioning already, and I'll say it again now, that I feel like you and I have paid attention to a lot of the same things, particularly the history of psychiatry and of psychology and of current practices in psychology and psychiatry, and the variety of paradigms that exist in the world today around what it means to thrive as a human being and what mental health is and how we should understand mental disorders and appropriate treatments and interventions. You yourself are a clinical psychologist, and I don't want to get the name of your center wrong, the Center for Integrated Behavioral Health? Close.
Correct.
Okay, the Center for Integrated Behavioral Health. Located in Pennsylvania, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania?
Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, about a mile from Lehigh University.
Nice. And I imagine you've had telehealth services available too?
We've adapted well during the pandemic, so we've been able to provide both in-person and telehealth services. It's been somewhat of a process of adaptation for all of us trying to determine who's the best fit for telehealth services. But ultimately, I think we've been able to see that we can even advance our care and our treatment by providing telehealth. And for the right person at the right time, it can be extraordinarily helpful and extraordinarily helpful for those who have a difficult time getting into the office, which traditionally in outpatient mental health, there's been some statistics that show there could be up 25 to 30% no-show rates. So being able to provide adequate care for the people who really need it, it certainly remains a challenge for us in our field. And the telehealth approach is an opportunity for all of us to be able to reach more people and to provide a greater continuity of care. Some of the statistics and outcome statistics that we've developed at our practice, one of the things that are really important for a completion of treatment and an effective outcome is the frequency of sessions early on. So we believe if we can get people into our center and we can build a sound conceptualization that's very strongly based on evidence and self-monitoring, and it's very active and engaged, we can build this collaborative relationship and we can build a very understandable, sound conceptualization of what is influencing and maintaining the problems that they're experiencing. And we can use technology to do that. And so those who are going to attend to these early sessions increases the likelihood dramatically of being able to complete a course of treatment and whatever they're struggling, hopefully to be somewhat episodic, and they can develop new skills and be able to respond to the problems that they have in their life. Which is really aligned with what I believe in as far as sound evidence-based mental health care. One of the reasons you've brought me on this podcast is you've probably seen my Twitter, and I've gotten a number of comments recently from on one end of the spectrum, bold and much needed to continue the conversation, to having people on the other end of the spectrum believing I'm spreading misinformation and creating harm. And I think we get into this field, Nick, I'm sure you got into this field for a couple of reasons. One, I think we have this caring nature, empathy, and connection to people where we think it's of high value to try to improve the lives of others, combined with an intellectual curiosity about what leads people to suffer, develop mental health conditions. Conversely, what would lead people to thrive and overcome challenges? And that's the thing that's always been fascinating to me and what has drawn me to the field of psychology is I'm just as interested in people who have overcome trauma and tragedy to create a life worth living and one that could be influential. And what are those factors? You know, what are those things that are needed in a person's life to be able to overcome those challenges? And I feel like we're going in the wrong direction in mental health. You want to be part of a science-based and a field that that is going to evolve to be able to improve the well-being of society. But to be honest with you, every identifiable statistic suggests at this point that entering into the mental health system as currently constructed is increasing your likelihood of impairment. And that is concerning to me. And I felt like this was the time in my life and in my career that I wanted to become more vocal about this. And that includes highlighting the poor safety and efficacy of psychiatric drugs, how safe evidence-based treatments are rarely administered, and we've lost our ability to be able to talk about human resilience in a way that I think is extremely important. And we're creating almost a culture that thinks about their own mental health from a new paradigm, right? Emotional distress, emotional struggle are now discussed in terms of disability or illness. And what historically has been something that has been relatively episodic, and we have the ability to overcome. Human beings are incredibly resilient. We're starting to see these same conditions are becoming much more chronic.
Beautifully said. It's true. I think you nailed it. That what drew you to the field is what drew me to the field. I love the way you put it, that care and that empathy for people and the intellectual curiosity about human psychology. And I think you painted the picture very well. And it's what's been very interesting to me is to observe, like you said, the new paradigm is to think of emotional distress, especially if it's persisting, even for just some weeks, in terms of an illness. And it's been interesting to me, especially in communicating, you know, with people in the world on in the social online, you know, you have just access to so many more points of view. And so the point of view of how validating it feels for some people to think of it like an illness. And I think my assessment is what's behind it is partly this complete release of responsibility for what has happened, or fault rather is probably the better word there. It feels like they can finally say, this is not my fault. And I think that's partly, I've been trying to understand where is people's passion in that paradigm of let's expand the diagnostic criteria for every condition. Let's call these disorders. I've been trying to understand where is that passion coming from? Because I think the people who represent it, you know, really do care about people, of course. And I think it's rooted in that right there, is just being able to say it's not my fault. So just comment on that. But one thing I really wanted to ask you is, you emphasized the phrase sound conceptualization. And I would and you really kind of put the emphasis on the word sound. And I agree that there are sound conceptualizations and unsound conceptualizations of what's going on at the root of a person's emotional distress. So please talk to me about what is that sound conceptualization?
Yeah, that's a really good question. When we talk about providing any intervention within any science, it has to be based on a pretty sound evidence base that would suggest that there's a cause that is contributing to that problem. So if I'm diagnosed with strep throat, I would want to take an antibiotic to kill that bacteria. And if the antibiotic is effective and we tested positive for strep, we're at a high confirmation rate here that it was actually strep. Mm-hmm. And mental health disorders are quite the opposite. We're in a time where the numbers are astronomical as far as the increase in psychiatric prescriptions, especially for the younger generation, which is much concerning for me. From 2005 to 2019, close to a 40% increase in SSRI antidepressant prescriptions for teens ages 15 to 19. Obviously, a developmental period of rapid changes neurologically. And I would only imagine that increases in 2020. I haven't seen the data there. But what is the conceptualization that is based on? And if you talk to the general public, which I have an outpatient practice, we're a group center, and we are working within our community, the greater Lehigh Valley for the most part, overwhelmingly people will believe that if they experience anxiety and depression, which are two of the most common presentations, mental health presentations that are going to enter into outpatient practice. Now, there's going to be problem behaviors that can build off of that, from eating disorders to substance abuse. But overwhelmingly, people believe that there's an underlying brain abnormality or chemical imbalance that needs to be corrected with pharmaceuticals. And how do they know that? It has become now passed down generation to generation. It's a cultural myth. And it only gets reinforced by going into your primary care physician or seeing a psychiatrist, and within that short amount of time, talking about their distress in a certain way, and then writing that prescription. And that prescription is being written more frequently, with the consumers of those drugs being less and less informed about the actual efficacy and safety. It's almost assumed that this is just a matter of course. And again, since it's not based on sound conceptualization or science, we're providing an intervention that is going to have limited effect. And when you come back into my office, and my specialization is in cognitive and dialectical behavior therapy, and be happy to talk about more about that today, but a lot of the strength of cognitive behavioral therapies is it's a coping model and it's a skill-based model, and it's going to work with people based on the problems that they're experiencing right now. And it's an umbrella term for a lot of empirically validated interventions, but our treatment and our interventions have to be based on a sound conceptualization. That means we have to understand what is influencing the current problems that exist and what maintain it. And it takes time. An evaluation period for me is often multiple sessions just to do the clinical interview and the testing and some between session self-monitoring. Then there's multiple sessions building a conceptualization and agreement with my client. So this is usually taking at least a month. Now, compare that to our current healthcare system. That's about 15 minutes, 20 minutes going into your physician's office. Now, I understand the challenges that exist in our modern healthcare system, especially for pediatricians and primary care physicians, because they're overwhelmed and they want to do something. But their information that they're receiving, unfortunately, is more data that is from marketing pamphlets for pharmaceutical salespeople, rather than an in-depth knowledge of mental health conditions and their effective treatments. And the informed consent process is rarely ever provided. And in my history now, in doing this work, and it spans close to 20 years in various different settings, overwhelmingly, I observe that at best, clients report little to no change. And at worst, some life debilitating side effects and dependency. And now there is a whole community online of prescribed harm. And we need to listen to them because their stories matter. And unfortunately, in our field, at least what you see in the social media world, and that's one way to be able to get information, there tends to be a defensiveness that exists. And that is not my idea of science. My idea of science is that it evolves. Mm. And if we deeply care about the well-being of our clients, then what we're going to do is we're going to understand their stories and say, who's being harmed by this and why? What is happening? How can we advance the conversation and how can we advance treatments? And one of the things that is probably most concerning is when you get stuck in a certain way of thinking. And it certainly stems from the 1990s into the 2000s, where so much money was devoted to research to try to identify mental illness as a brain disorder. And when we begin stuck in that way of thinking, what unfortunately happens is we're limiting progress in other areas. Mm-hmm. And to think about mental health in such a restricted and limited way from a few neurochemicals, we fail to be able to advance the field and talk about the complexity of mental health. And that's what I want to do in my career moving forward, whether it's being on podcasts like this or starting my own podcast, which I recently began, and we're going to launch next week.
Radically genuine. Check it out.
Thank you for the plug. I want to be able to advance the conversation, because from the food we eat to the conditions which we live, to how we're treated, to how we treat others, is there genetic and biological components? Yes. And then there's social components as well. And you mentioned something that was, you know, fascinating before for me, which is the idea of viewing our experience as an illness serves some function for some people as if it's not my fault. Mm-hmm. And in DBT, there's a great saying, this is dialectical behavior therapy. I think Marshall Linehan probably started it. What has happened to you may not be your fault, but only you are responsible for changing it. So if it removes the responsibility for you to take control of your own health and your own life and the relationships in your life, or to face trauma that has happened, or to change eating patterns, or to overcome tragedy, if it stops you from taking those steps, well, then it doesn't help us. It doesn't help the client to take on that mentality. And I think we have to be more inspirational, and we have to talk about the capacity of human beings to become resilient and overcome problems. Now, that's not in any way to minimize some of the extreme challenges that exist. Obviously, there are people that are very ill. Schizophrenia, psychotic conditions, has influences homelessness. There's a lot of complexity to this, and those severe and chronic mental illnesses, we do need so much more research and understanding into that. But that is historically a very small portion of the mental health population. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about people now who are seeking mental health services, they're overwhelmingly conditions that can be treated effectively in various settings, but are now becoming much more chronic because of our response to them. And the way that we're beginning to think about our emotional experience, there is somewhat between, you know, data suggest 400 to 700% increase in the diagnosis of bipolar from the 1970s to the 2000s. You know, bipolar disorder and bipolar 1 disorder, as we know it, that manic depressive illness, you know, affected somewhere between 0.04 to maybe 1% of the worldwide population. I mean, it's being diagnosed 5 to 7% now. Mm-hmm. And that's because you add in a disorder, bipolar 2, that is way too nebulous in general, that in anyone who has emotion dysregulation episodes can now self-identify as bipolar. And it's very easily diagnosed in medical settings. And you're provided a mood stabilizer. Recently just did an evaluation, and this is way too common, that you see somebody, it's often young women who have a history of either sexual or physical violence and have pretty clear PTSD symptoms, and struggle within the context of developing safe, intimate relationships with partners. And within those specific contexts, either self-injure to self-regulate or make suicidal threats or enter into suicidal planning or thinking. And these clients who enter into the hospital system in the United States, almost 100% of the time are walking out with a bipolar diagnosis. And that goes back to, what is the sound conceptualization? What would be the effective treatment for somebody who is going through that? And in my opinion, we do have some safe, effective treatments. And we, for example, dialectical behavior therapy is one of them. If it's available, it's a skill-based treatment. It's rather intensive. It includes coaching consultations, which is a new way of being able to administer mental health treatment. But you can stabilize some of these patterns and then enter into another stage of therapy where you can address the traumatic history. And so that's how I look at evidence-based care. The most safe and the most effective treatment should be administered first, based on that conceptualization. Mm-hmm. Now, you have clients who then are coming into the evaluation already on multiple psychiatric drugs. They don't feel well physically. We don't know what is a symptom of the original problem versus the side effect of the medication or an interaction effect. And it makes our jobs really difficult. And so I've taken the stance in my practice to try to work with the prescribers to try to safely titrate down and go baseline, and let me take that time and let us administer and at least a sound evaluation to understand what is happening. And overwhelmingly, what we see are the clients begin to feel better in time once they come off the medication. Now, not always, and not right away, because there are some significant withdrawal effects depending on how often they've been on the drugs. But when you see people starting to feel better, getting off the treatment that they were on, you understand that the cure has become the disease in a lot of instances. And of course, you know, this is not in any way targeting brain abnormalities. It's kind of creating a brain dysfunction or abnormality.
Oh, yeah.
So once you take these drugs, it's very important that you are under the care of a physician and you're being monitored. And that the type of monitoring and care once people are placed on these psychiatric drugs is poor or absent. You know, sometimes they're just these check-ins. So
on this,
that's a long-winded answer to your question, but conceptualization should drive intervention and should be on some sound science.
Mm. Yeah, and it's funny that the phrase long-winded has a bad reputation, but I like long-winded. Long-winded is nuanced. I like it. So much to say about this, and you know, I just resonate very strongly with it. And when we talk about these conceptualizations or these paradigms within the field of mental health, I think it's helpful to kind of consider some key terms, which are etiology, right? Mm-hmm. Diagnostic description, prognosis, and treatment. These are kind of four big bullet points where you can find alignment within one conceptualization or another, right? And so first of all, on the level of diagnosis, there is the differing views that diagnostic overexpansion is good and diagnostic overexpansion is more problematic than good. And diagnostic overexpansion is exactly what Roger was just describing with the addition of bipolar 2, which is just so much more open to interpretation, and the criteria for each disorder have become looser. It doesn't take as much anymore to be diagnosed with something. You can imagine a bell curve. And of course, you know, with any condition, there's going to be the right side of the bell curve, that top percentile, that most rare, the outliers who experience extreme, easily recognizable disorders like extreme schizophrenia, psychosis, But then it's like more and more of the bell curve is being included into what a disorder is. And additionally, some people draw a really firm line between who does and who doesn't have a disorder. And some people see it much more as a continuum, where it's true that any of us can be depressed to some level of intensity and for some length of time. So what level of intensity and what length of time exactly do we draw the line and say, okay, now this is clinical? So there's different views on that. And then on etiology, like you were saying, the narrative is that there's a chemical imbalance. This, I mean, I think no one would claim this seriously anymore, but still, that's what the science of psychiatric drugs are based on, is the idea of the chemical imbalance. I feel like, as you mentioned, with the comment that kind of the cure is in the disease and that they're causing dysfunction, I feel like that's what Robert Whittaker's work showed us. I think that's the insight that really emerged from his exhaustive analysis of psychiatric literature, was that ultimately long-term use of psychiatric drugs does more harm than good. And just, you know, I mean, it's like, I don't want to hog the mic here, but I'll just say too that in these differing views on the level of etiology, there's some, it goes even deeper. It goes, I think, into a person's philosophy of the relationship between the mind and the body. And some people only see the causal arrows as pointing from the body to the mind. The mind is a byproduct of brain activity. Therefore, whatever's happening in the mind is because of the brain. And then that's one thing to have kind of a materialistic view, but to then also have this super simplified idea of a chemical imbalance that is accounting for these very subtly complex experiences that people are having, right? Is another thing. So in other words, you can be a materialist and think that the mind is a byproduct of the brain, but still reject a chemical imbalance theory or any simplified biological explanation of what's happening. We all bow to the complexity and mystery of the brain, but then we widely accept like this super simple explanation for what is accounting for someone's subjective experience. And then some people also would argue that the causal arrows between the body and the mind point in both directions. And just because there is a neurological abnormality, it doesn't mean that that's actually the origin. There can be a psychological issue, a fundamentally psychological issue that is based on an experience a person had that is causing, as some people say, that has neurological correlates, not causes, that it's actually, and therefore the neurological activity can change if there's a change on a mental level. So many more directions we can go with this, but I'm just kind of trying to really highlight what these different conceptualizations are. And so the other thing I wanted to say quickly is, I appreciate, you know, what you described about how long your intake is with people, how long you get to know people before really trying to diagnose them with anything. And I just wanted to read something, a statement put out by the New Zealand Psychology Society when they did their review of the DSM-5 as it was being published. They were part of the voices that were criticizing diagnostic overexpansion, and they wrote, "The practitioner must look beyond the mental disorder and develop an appreciation of the complexity and uniqueness of the individual." And I feel like you do that, you develop that appreciation. So of the many directions this can go, I'm gonna try to channel us here. And I wanted to bring up something that I think listeners will find kind of compelling. You started talking about psychiatric drugs. You tweeted something out like late May, and I'll even read it. Let me pull it up here. So you wrote, for those struggling with anxiety and mood, this could save lives. And then some bullet points like check vitamin D levels, prescribe daily exercise and follow up, behavioral sleep interventions, diet change, problem-focused behavioral therapy, meditation, sun, wean off SSRIs and benzos. And then as I'll let you talk about your experience with this, but you know, you got what you were describing there between strong agreement and strong disagreement, even kind of defensive attacks type of disagreement, including a retweet from Ellen Francis, who is the chair of the DSM 3 and 4, or maybe just 4, but definitely 4. So tell me about your experience of that and I'll have follow-up questions, but let me just hear your take.
Sure. It's interesting because I thought that tweet was rather benign. Mm-hmm. Because it just speaks to the complexities of mood. And to begin to open up the conversation about all the factors that could be influencing poor health and poor mood. And we know things like exercise is the most effective antidepressant ever created. You can put it up against anything and someone's going to feel better. We have this direct ability to change our experience and alter neurochemicals through our experience, right? Through our activity, through our thinking, through our memory. It's a very complex system, as you described before. I think the biggest problem with that tweet was I talked about weaning off SSRIs with benzodiazepines. As if I was giving people permission to just stop taking those drugs abruptly, or I was providing medical advice as a clinical psychologist, when in fact it was to bring attention to the fact those two drugs themselves could be creating the exact symptomology and problems that you were taking the drugs to alleviate. We know the dangers of benzodiazepines, which are designed for short-term use, have been prescribed for upwards of 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I've seen that in my clinical, in my office, and even prescribed to teens. So these substances that are designed to target these depressive and anxiety symptoms can also be creating the exact problems that you're looking to alleviate. Mm-hmm. And so that was my point there with that tweet. But I think we need to speak to the complexity of how one feels. And so that tweet was related to exercise, nutrition, lifestyle habits. If you are struggling to sleep, it is very difficult to feel good. Mm. And I'm also a big believer in understanding evolutionary biology. I believe our emotions mm-hmm. are gifts from our ancestors. They're designed to help us thrive in this world. We want to be able to understand them and pay attention to them. So if we are experiencing depressed mood, low mood, or anxiety, obviously we want to understand those emotions and ask ourselves, what do we need to face? What are we feeling? For what purpose? So when I talk about problem-solving behavioral approaches, that's just the clinical word for, hey, you feel bad for a reason. Mm-hmm. Let's do something about it, right? And often that in itself will alleviate the distress, right? Your distress is there for a reason, which is one of the greatest concerns of the developing generations who've viewed mental health related conditions to be a biological disease, is that it might stop them from being able to fully understand what they're feeling and what they can do about it.
Right. Let me say about the tweet that, you know what my thought was, honestly? My thought was, what if you would have said, wean off of your alcohol dependency? Would you have gotten the same reaction? And my strong sense is, no way. Like, people would be like, yeah, that's a good call. You should not drink so much alcohol. Or what if you said, like, you know, wean off cocaine every weekend, wean off cannabis every morning, wean off of any socially sanctioned psychoactive substance? You would not have been, I don't think, kind of ridiculed, or what, I don't know, that's not the right word exactly, but you wouldn't have been met with such defensiveness. And I think people think that psychiatric drugs are more different than they really are from all these other psychoactive substances. They are not, it's not like, my sense was that people were reacting as if you said, if you're diabetic, you should start to wean yourself off of insulin. And that's not the same as psychiatric drugs, but people responded as if it was like that. So that was my thought when I saw that.
Yeah, it's such a great point because it's a regulated prescription drug provided by your physician, then therefore it must be necessary to treat your disease.
Right.
But yet all these other substances, and throughout human history, humans have tried to turn to substance to alter their experience. I think it speaks more to some of the challenges of living, the challenges of being human, of trying to turn to a substance to alter your state. And what is accepted in society is alcohol use. Cannabis is becoming much more accepted in society. And so we view it differently. We understand that in excess, these things can be really problematic and affect our mood. But it's this idea that these regulated prescription drugs somehow are much more effective than what they actually are. And you made an excellent point. They're all just psychoactive substances. And I don't think, Nick, that most psychologists or therapists think about the complexity of this in terms of coping. It is inconsistent with everything I know on emotion regulation to turn to a substance to try to change the way I feel. And there is this false notion out there that the standard of care in mental health should be psychotherapy and psychiatric drugs. And so what happens with a lot of mental health therapists, which are overwhelmingly social workers and counselors, it's just an automatic referral to a physician for a psychiatric drug to assume that those two combined are most effective. And again, that is nothing that's supported by strong science. Obviously, we can look back through the research. Many are industry-driven, poor methodology, and they're trying to make that case for it. And the pharmaceutical companies try to make that case for it because it increases their sales. But if I'm a cognitive behavioral psychologist and I am really interested in like fear extinction and emotion regulation, inhibitory learning models of fear extinction, I want to know, how does somebody regulate their internal states in order to be effective in their lives? Mm-hmm. And you realize that it has nothing to do with necessarily the intensity of your emotions. It has to do with your response to it. So I can be really anxious right now. Maybe you don't know it, because I've practiced various skills to be able to regulate that experience, to be able to focus my attention here. And that helps me have a sense of equilibrium and focus. But you have to be trained. You have to train yourself to do it. And a lot of evidence-based psychotherapies are going to have some exposure component to it for these very reasons, because we have the ability to regulate intense negative affective states, respond to internal stimuli, whether that's thoughts or memories. And we know that the avoidance of such is problematic in the development of psychological conditions.
I'll just interject really quick and say that I just had a conversation with a clinical psychologist, Shiva Guide, who survived the Vegas shooting. She was there and she was literally, people were dying right around her. She was traumatized by that. Mm-hmm. And then went on to kind of heal and help others heal, and wrote a book about healing from mass trauma and violence. And this is one thing she totally emphasizes, is what you were just saying, the importance of not avoiding conditioned stimuli, you know, and things that cause fear. So I just wanted to interject and kind of fuel that, you know, and say that you're certainly doing something that I think a psychologist who's uniquely equipped to speak on this agrees with completely. So
Right.
Good.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, it's an excellent point, because you're talking about how do human beings heal from painful, traumatic experiences, right?
Yep.
And there's a part of us that wants to run away from anything that's kind of scary, right? And that's built into our DNA as well. But even when you look into the literature of post-traumatic stress conditions or disorders, what makes it a disorder is often like maintained by avoidant coping. So if somebody has been exposed to an acute stressor or a traumatic experience, all mental health therapists should know that there is a period of time where that person at their own pace needs to be able to think about what happened to them, grieve, feel the emotions related to it, and begin to return back to their life again. And anything that inhibits that can then create problems down the line, from their nervous system being highly activated from any reminders. When you begin to restrict your life, you begin to certainly restrict joy and other positive emotions. You begin to impair your ability to function actively and fully in your life. We know that nightmares are kind of a result of that brain's need to be able to process through that painful event and make sense of it. Mm-hmm. So that's why nightmares and sleep disruption and avoidance of trauma memories and hypervigilance are more of a disordered state or a response to somebody who is not facing what happened to them. And strong effective therapies allow clients to be able to face that and return to previous functioning to the best that they can. You're changed forever when you experience trauma, but you can be changed forever in a way that also allows you to develop this post-traumatic growth and incredible wisdom. My work with trauma patients is the most fulfilling work that I do, because what they've had to go through and what they've had to overcome gives me an insight into human resiliency and how amazing people can actually be, what they're capable of, how strong people can be. And it's really formed my opinion on what people can recover from and who they can become post-traumatic events.
Mm-hmm.
But bottom line is, like, the ability to face that and expose yourself to that, you develop this inhibitory learning process where you now go from "I can't handle this" to "I can handle this." And so, to go back to our conversation about how the use of psychiatric drugs can impair coping, it's often this idea, I cannot handle what I'm feeling. And that turning to that substance to try to feel better or for relief impairs a person's ability to recover and respond.
I like what you just said there at the end. It's the feeling of, I can't handle what I'm feeling. And how empowering it is to have a shift into, I can handle what I'm feeling. That's insightful to me. It's hitting me kind of hard, because it's like that's at the forefront of experience at all times, what I'm feeling about what's happening. And interesting.
And our clients have to trust their experience, right? Mm-hmm. There's this concept of invalidation. What is invalidation, right? It's like, it's your thoughts or your experiences are somehow devalued or they don't matter. And this can happen in the healthcare system, right? I think quick prescriptions are invalidation in the healthcare system, because it doesn't speak to the complexities of what they may be going through and what they may need to be able to feel better. Because that prescription, even for the small amount of people where it might have some effect, is nothing more than some affect blunting, some emotional numbing. And that is not helping them to face the problems that exist and to overcome them.
Amen. And it's so interesting, especially again, because I've been having more interactions with people who would disagree with what we're talking about. Lately, I've been really trying my hardest to understand view and allow mine to be changed by it, like to truly listen. And I think there's a couple things I would want to say kind of in that spirit, which is one, I think there's a spectrum of practice among psychiatrists where some really do spend much more time with the individual before making a diagnosis. And they might not make, some actually might not make a diagnosis. And then there's the middle, and then there's on the other extreme end, the people who are truly just going through the motions, writing diagnoses and prescriptions within 10 minutes of meeting somebody. Every check-in is just automated in a sense. And where am, how do I know this? What am I talking about? Like how do I, this is my experience of observing this. One, when I did my dissertation, it involved like different treatments for schizophrenia. And so it was a multiple case study. So it was just three people that I was investigating. But for two of them, I was able to get the psychiatrist's notes and listen to the person talk about their experience with the psychiatrist. And it's exactly what I'm talking about. And sometimes worse, it was even kind of hostile and anxiety inducing to be alone in the office with him. And then additionally, I work in a jail, and there's a psychiatrist who works in there. And I know by talking to the inmates that I know what that interaction is. And it's basically like this unspoken agreement of like, I need drugs, you know, and this is like, might be surprising for people to hear, but think about the fact that many people in jail are in there on drug charges. And many of them are coming into jail after a bender where they're craving hard methamphetamine, alcohol, heroin. And they know that there are mind altering substances available within this jailhouse. Sometimes they're snuck in, not that I've heard, but also like in a legitimate way. And then I've known many people to meander, to do the thing where they go in and just pretend that they have something. They know what symptoms to say. This one woman told me about this time. She went in and pretended that there was a piranha on her shoulder. She pretended she was hallucinating. And so she would like interact with it in the middle of the session. And this woman was just so lucid in getting to know her. She's just a highly intelligent woman with a drug addiction and knew exactly what strategy she needed to employ to get her equivalent of heroin, as she put it, which was Seroquel, a high dose of Seroquel. And that basically kind of bridged the time of between being able to use heroin. So, and I know that also, I'll just one more comment kind of based on this experience. The psychiatrist in there, I had a conversation with him once because I was asking him about the drug Risperdal. And he explained that it was essentially a dopamine blocker. And then when I was parting ways with him, he had this one last comment, which was, but no one really knows the downstream effect of any of this. And I was like, yeah, that's a good way to put it. The downstream effect is all the other chemical reactions that were going to happen at that dopamine synapse you just blocked. It's not like any chemical reaction occurs in isolation. So he was just admitting that we don't know the downstream effects of this. And so I just kind of had like both points of view, the inmate and their thoughts about the psychiatrist, and then the psychiatrist and his understanding of the drugs he was prescribing. And it was almost like through these experiences, that line between legal and illegal drugs was erased in my mind. And now I just see things as psychoactive substances. And the one thing that pharmaceutical drugs have over street drugs is that they're clean, they're pure, they're not cut with anything. And that is a big deal. Like that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. People are cutting heroin with fentanyl and stuff like that now on the streets, and it's horrifying. So you're not going to get, you know, a little too much fentanyl in your drug, but it's a drug. And when you talk to people who have used both, let's say methamphetamine and Adderall, especially at high doses, they tell you that they're subjectively identical. So anyway, that's just...
So it's a fascinating point and brings up some interesting questions. So to try to be maybe a little bit more dialectical in this conversation, do drugs have a place in society? And we can argue on one side, because it is mood altering. It alters cognition, alters the state of the human experience. And are there a percentage of people that doing that and somehow acts as like an emergency medicine of stabilization and can improve their quality of life? I think reasonable people can have that dialogue and we can stay away from the extremes. My concern though is twofold. One, exactly what you were pointing to, the downstream effect. Are these clients making an informed decision, understanding the potential consequences long-term, and then the widespread prescriptions that are being provided to the general population or just human distress. And so those are the two greatest concerns for me, because I think there can be some utility for some people in a short-term way, but we have not found the magic pill. It's clear. And I think the science is clear. We just need to have more people articulating that to the general population and to our clients so they can get the safest, most effective supportive care that they can receive.
And it's worth the shout out too. You know, like I wanted to acknowledge the psychiatrists who are very careful and who are brilliant and who do a really good job. And I thank you for them. I thank you if you're listening and that type of psychiatrist. And then I also want to acknowledge the people who, like you just said, find that it's very helpful, find that drugs are very helpful, and who would kind of, I think my imaginary version of them in this conversation right now would be like, actually, drugs enabled me to get back on my feet and start living a normal life, and that they're very helpful. And so I acknowledge that. And I would maybe boldly argue that we should perhaps think of people who are drinking alcohol every day in the same way, and perhaps only give the drugs that are helpful as much respect, I'll say, as we give alcohol. Because we have reasonable conversations about whether things like alcohol and cannabis are appropriate to use at all. And most people would say yes in moderation or in a very conscious way. And so maybe there's a similar conversation to be had about the use of drugs. I mean, granted, the other factor is that some things are more addictive than others. Some things are harder to stop than others. So I'm not trying to say that we can have a conversation about all substances in general. We need to, of course, take them one by one. But anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge that I understand drugs have helped people, and that's wonderful. And glasses of wine have helped people, and that's wonderful. And joints of weed have helped people, and that's wonderful. And these psychoactive substances are not as different as we tend to make them out to be.
Exactly. My greatest concern, and my practice has now developed a position statement on SSRIs for children and adolescents. So we can sit here, there might be a veteran who is at home right now and who's gotten mental health care, and he's smoking cannabis every night and it helps him sleep. And if we pull this conversation to the extremes and say all drugs are bad in all conditions and all situations, well, then people like that tune us out and they shut us out. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we're saying. I think it's ultimately a question about quality of life. And we have to be able to study the quality of life of individuals who turn to any type of substance to see whether that stabilizes and improves their quality of life or harms it. But one thing we know for sure is that when you start introducing substances to developing brains and children who cannot make or consent for an informed decision and require adults to be able to protect them during this vulnerable period, the more that we keep increasing these prescription drugs for behavioral problems, for mood dysregulation, the lability in mood that has in the past been part of the trials and tribulations of adolescence in that developmental period, we are creating harm. We do not have efficacy for SSRIs for teenagers and young adults. In fact, all the available evidence will say it's a pretty significant increase in suicidal events compared to placebo. We don't have any valuable data that says it makes any improvement. So to be providing them as a frontline intervention during that vulnerable period of time, I find it criminal. And I can make the statement criminal to go to that other extreme, to be able to shock people into this, to be able to begin to look at the literature, the safety and efficacy of these drugs, and remember the messages that you are sending for a young developing individual about coping. And our physicians, and I think the last I saw, like overwhelmingly primary care physicians, pediatricians now writing these scripts, it's not even psychiatry. That just shows the overwhelming demand for mental health services. It's the physicians out there who are being infiltrated by pharmaceutical companies through symptom checklists that are going to pretty much identify almost everyone who takes them as mentally ill. And so I hope that anyone that's listening to this can have an open mind and take a look at what we are now doing to children and adolescents in society and try to think about the impact on that, on them.
Preach, brother. I appreciate you saying this. I feel like of the injustices in the world, the psychiatric drugging of children is one of the lowest hanging fruits here that we can address. That's like, who defends this? I mean, again, I keep emphasizing perhaps more than usual, perhaps it's coming to me stronger than usual right now, but it's helpful to think about psychiatric drugs as not as different as we're led to believe as illicit drugs. And just think about how you would react if you heard someone say, my child gets pretty irritable at night, so I'll give him a shot of vodka, or I let him hit the joint, or, you know, or just drink coffee in the morning. We revolt against that idea.
Yeah, not only that, I think that's criteria for a referral to Child Protective Services. Giving their own child drugs and alcohol.
Let me ask you this question on this note. I often address this with classes of students. We talk about this. We look at the data of exactly how many, for example, babies. I'm not exaggerating. There are babies under 1 year old who are prescribed antipsychotics, antidepressants, and anti-anxiety drugs, and then toddlers, and then young children, and then teenagers across the lifespan. And so my question to you is, what do you think about the role of the parent in that? I'm always careful, and I don't want to make parents feel ashamed of that, and I understand why they trust their doctor. So what are your thoughts about like that? Like, who's responsible? What's the parent's role?
Well, ultimately, for a society to function well, we have to have trust in our healthcare professionals. And in American society, the physicians, the medical class, is put on a pedestal, and we trust them as if their knowledge, their background, and their education is undoubtedly going to be used for the betterment of our health. And I think that trust has been broken down definitely in the last year with a lot of public health recommendations. But in the field of psychiatry, the legitimacy of psychiatry as a sound science should be questioned. And so you as a parent, they both are true. You as a parent, us as parents, I have three kids myself, we are ultimately responsible, and we should question and research everything. And a lot of parents are doing that. I think that there's an increase in an awareness about how psychiatric drugs at this point, 30 plus years on the market, haven't really improved the well-being of society. Every statistic shows that there's just an increase in mental health conditions, suicide events, hospitalizations. It's just that a lot of parents become scared. And when they're scared, they're vulnerable and they want to do whatever they can to be able to help their child. And if a physician is telling them you need to take this drug to keep your child alive, there's not many parents who are going to go against medical advice. So I'm putting the responsibility and accountability on the physicians. And they have an ethical responsibility to first do no harm. And it's interesting, I make comments on Twitter, or sometimes even I'll share my thoughts with patients and part of an informed consent process, and they'll question whether this is within my boundaries of competence. But I'll tell you, most of the physicians writing the scripts, which are that primary care or pediatrician, do not have the background or training to be able to treat, first understand, assess, diagnose, and or treat mental health conditions. That, you know, half a year, you know, rotation in psychiatry during your residency is just not sufficient, right? So it's just where the medical profession is on the hierarchy within our class system. And so I do believe that they have a responsibility to protect the welfare of their patients.
It's interesting to think too about two things that I want to make sure we address. One is I love the way you really emphasize what I would describe as the basics of mental health, the simple things that you can implement and make habits out of, like sleep and exercise and lifestyle factors. And it's very interesting because I feel like people don't take that seriously when they hear it, especially if they don't have prior experience, for example, with exercise and how almost euphoric and wonderful you can feel after exercise. So people are dismissive of this, but I just want to kind of align with you and advocate it as well, that if we really take these things seriously, I mean, you've summed them up in that tweet I read. The ones I always find myself hitting on are sleep and exercise and nutrition and social connection and meaning in life. If you were to really take those seriously and be sure that those needs are met, what condition would persist, right? And maybe none. I would imagine that none would, but if some do, then you have much more of an understanding of what needs to be done.
I started my career researching and treating eating disorders. Mm. And obviously when it comes to treating anorexia, food is the medicine. And so in understanding what happens to the individual when you're nutritionally deprived, psychiatric symptoms become present, right? So you're nutritionally deprived. Many of those clients who are underweight become extremely anxious, controlled, even would meet criteria for obsessive compulsive disorder, have this incredible urge to have to move, flat mood, flat affect. And that is what happens to the brain that's nutritionally deprived. I've become very interested in just the overall health of our nation right now, especially when you're coming out of a pandemic or you are within the uncertainty of a pandemic. The obesity rate in our country has skyrocketed. Our food source is poor. We're exposed to chemicals. I think I read something like 70% decrease in sperm from the 1970s, decreased testosterone. There's a lot of like factors related to our health that would contribute to poor mood, sleep problems, low energy. And At a point in my life, I had a father who died suddenly of a heart attack on his 50th birthday, which was shocking to our entire family because we didn't really have those signs. And I'm going to be 45 years old this summer. And as I dangerously get close to that middle age period in which he passed, I'm more and more focused on all lifestyle factors. And I can tell you, if there's a number of things that I don't do in a day, I'm affected. And for someone like myself, who can sometimes see 6 to 7 patients in one day, and I love what I do. And when I'm taking care of myself, I'm incredibly focused and engaged with them. But if I don't exercise, if I don't meditate, if I ate poorly, if there is something going on within my life that's really important to me, such as something going on with my kids, my wife, my family, someone I'm concerned about, I am affected. It's more difficult for me to stay focused, to concentrate, to feel empathy, to feel good, to sleep that night. If any of those things in that routine are disrupted, I am impacted. Now, I'm out there in the sun, I'm moving, I'm exercising, things are stable within my family, I've meditated, I feel really good. And I don't want to oversimplify things like that, because people are going through some very complex problems, right? And it gets us to think about mental health also from a societal perspective. Like, if your safety and security is threatened, don't expect to feel good. You can't feel good. Right. If you're trying to feed your family, you're not going to feel good. You're actually evolutionarily designed to feel anxious and concerned about it. You're going to try to figure out and solve that problem. So we need to advance the conversation on what it means to feel good, including all those lifestyle factors, and to be able to understand the socioeconomic mm-hmm. factors that influence, you know, a person's ability to live healthy too.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, beautiful explanation. And, you know, it's like the ultimate thing is a person has to just try it out. We can listen to people testify and show data about, like you said earlier, the fact that exercise will outperform anything on in terms of mood elevation and overall energy. It's amazing, you know, and it's just, you can't encapsulate those effects into a pill. So it's hard, you know, to put in that time. But I think another thing that's kind of fresh on my mind, a little controversial, but this is what that psychologist, Dr. Shiva Guide, also said. One of her kind of rules is, as she puts it, fuck feelings. If it's healthy, do it anyway. And there's, I think, some power in that. And she's, of course, very careful about acknowledging the importance of feelings and honoring feelings and understanding them, but also recognizing when some habitual emotional state is preventing you from doing something good for yourself. And to override that, at some point we can override that and just do it anyway. And so if a person, I think, were to take these basic things seriously and just do it no matter what with tremendous discipline, I think, you know, it would become a habit. And the other thing I also think is important to emphasize is that we're meant to make this personalized and enjoyable for ourselves. Like, I think many people hear exercise and they're like, okay, what, run on a treadmill at a gym, and averse to that idea. But it's just dance, virtual reality box, do whatever feels good to you. And then in terms, like you said, with sleep, any human being that is sleep deprived for long enough will have symptoms that could, I would assert, be diagnosed as a mental disorder. So who knows? Maybe the disorder is a presentation of the symptoms of chronic sleep deprivation sometimes. And if you never emphasize those first line defenses first, you would never understand the true origin. I think many, many things will disappear. And then again, if a condition is persisting upon meeting lifestyle factors, which sometimes happens, then you can create a much more targeted intervention to help solve that.
And imagine being a mental health professional and not even asking those questions. Mm. You know, that's unfortunately way too routine. You were describing a dialectical behavior therapy skill in emotion regulation called opposite action. Mm. And the psychologist you referred to said, fuck feelings. Mm-hmm. Instead, you know, we're going to refer to it as, if you are completely controlled by what your emotion is telling you to do, then you are you're living a life by your emotions. So if you're depressed, you're going to isolate. You're not going to move. And what's going to happen? It's going to worsen your depression. But if you employ opposite action, you know that when you don't feel like moving and exercising, that's when you know you have to. You're going to act opposite of the emotion. And just by doing that is an improvement in mood. In fact, sometimes that is the most important time to do something, when you don't actually feel like doing it.
Yes. Mood follows action is, I think, a good kind of thought to insert into your mental software. And it seems to be absolutely true that mood can precede action. Of course, we jump for joy because we're excited sometimes, but sometimes mood can follow action. I just had a very clear experience of that this morning. I just woke up and I was a little sleep deprived. I was in a bad mood, didn't have any coffee or anything. I was hungry. And I took a walk in a nearby forest with my dog. And I felt a very clear moment too, where there was a mood shift. I felt different and I was much more content. And so again, it's like, we don't want to simplify anything. We understand that sometimes there are very complex psychological things that need to be worked out. But it's empowering also to know that you can regulate your mood, and that sometimes acting, behaving, initiating some type of action is the most straightforward way to do it sometimes. That's my thought.
Yeah. And you were also talking about your connection to nature. The more we get removed from nature, I think the worse we're going to feel. You know, imagine working a 9-to-5 job with not even in any windows in a cubicle, and then like returning home and then staying inside and then eating poor food. And, you know, all these factors they contribute to the decline in the physical and mental health of us as a society. And there's a lot of things that have to return to basics, and from the quality of the food we eat to return to nature. And, you know, sun exposure is so important, from those infrared rays, vitamin D, melatonin. We know it's immune boosting and it's mood boosting. So, you know, the type of exercise matters, like being connected to nature, being out in sun, much better than being on a treadmill in the gym. Mm-hmm. Although being on a treadmill in the gym and moving your body is better than doing nothing. You could really enhance the entire experience by being outside. And I already, you know, understand that there's people out there just eye roll at that, of this kind of stuff. But what I say is, if these foundations aren't there, don't expect to feel good. Mm-hmm. You know, if your life is in your phone, if you're not exercising, if you're eating poor, if you haven't been able to develop a sleep schedule and structure and getting enough sleep, if you're abusing or using too much of mind altering substances, you know, all these are major primary factors in poor mood and poor quality of life. And you have to begin to address those if you ever even want to feel good. And in today's healthcare system, unfortunately, these questions aren't even asked. It's just the fact that someone doesn't feel good. Some pharmaceutical agent is being provided as if it's going to solve or change those problems, and it won't.
What's very striking to me too is the way that, like you said, with the evolutionary basis of emotions, that they are often indeed signals that you need to change behavior or circumstances in some way for the sake of your own thriving. And I think sometimes people's self-actualization is thwarted by chemical dependencies on whatever drug we're talking about, because those signals are kind of guiding you on a path of growth in many ways. And so to lose access to those signals, I think, is devastating to the process of self-actualization.
I 100% agree. I don't think we talk about the value of struggle or suffering or emotional pain enough. It is often the times where the greatest leaps in self-actualization or personal growth can occur. you know, it's within that pain, we begin to clarify our values and clarify our purpose. I would never want anyone to live a life trying to avoid emotional pain, because you're never going to fall in love. That self-protection nature is going to limit your ability to connect and engage. Hey, there's memento mori, is the Latin phrase for something to the effect of, like, we will all die one day, you know, our life will end. And there's power in being able to see your life as time limited and to think about how you want that life to be, which is clarification of values. When we're talking about things that are necessary for people to feel good, a sense of purpose in this life is really matters. And in my work and the different things that I've done throughout the course of my career, even before I became a psychologist, you know, we opened up the conversation in this way, talking about how people have been exposed to horrific circumstances, yet somehow find a way to thrive. And I remember a grandmother who was raising her 8-year-old granddaughter in an impoverished area, who she lost 2 children to substance abuse. And she was one of the wisest people that I ever came across, because the pain that she felt really clarified her sense of purpose. Now, she was someone of deep faith, but she really contributed to her community. And raising her granddaughter was something of incredible value to her. So each day she got up and she went to church. She served others in her community with her volunteer work. And she was invested in the life of her granddaughter. And she always recognized that her life was limited. And each day was a gift, and she lived it in that way. And that type of mindset, attitude, and value-driven life is one, when I was young at that time, going into homes, working with families, with struggling kids and teens. This is before I even became a psychologist. You begin to develop a sense of understanding about human resiliency and what people are capable of. How does someone like her get to that place, given the pain that she has suffered, the loss she has suffered? And I would wish that we as the mental health field would be talking more about that, mm-hmm. instead of and too many times talking about victimization and dependency and disability and illness. I don't think it's the path that we want to take as a field of mental health moving forward.
Mm, beautiful and beautiful human being that you described there. Yeah. And as kind of a last thought, I'll share. If you were to take someone in terrible circumstances, impoverished and endangered on a daily basis, and put them in a vacuum in a psychiatrist's office, a lot of the symptoms they would present could easily be diagnosed as a disorder. And I trust that there are many good psychiatrists who would realize the situation they were in and not diagnose them. But I also, unfortunately, trust that there would be a percentage of psychiatrists who have and would diagnose someone almost independent of those situational factors, or with no consideration of how they're clearly explaining why this person is so anxious. And so that, to me, highlights that in an interesting way, perhaps there's like a collective actualization or justice in many different ways that is also being thwarted by people being sedated by drugs. Because, you know, for example, it's just as an extreme hypothetical, imagine if before women had the right to vote, a huge enough percentage of women were drugged heavily enough to where they never really felt angry about it, right? So they would no longer present with the symptom of anger, but that anger was justified. It was necessary to change circumstances toward a more just world. And I think that there are still examples of, we're not quite at a perfect world yet. And sometimes it's very important to feel mad for a long time because of something that's not right in the world, be it in your small circle or the large world. And so I just think that's another factor here, that we have to honor human emotion, even when it's super intense and unpleasant, because sometimes it's exactly what's necessary to evolve on an individual level or socially.
I love it. Right behind me in my office there, there is a little saying, and one of my clients gave it to me. It's a picture of Yoda. Mm-hmm. And it says, fear your emotions not, for your emotions are your greatest superpower. And then she put Dr. McYoda on there. That was part of the theme of our work. That was a client who completed a full year of comprehensive dialectical behavior therapy. And she learned how to regulate her emotions and tolerate distress. And within that, there was this great acceptance for what she was feeling. Actually, it's more than an acceptance. It's viewing it as a superpower. What am I feeling and how can I use it to benefit me now? Which is so different than judging that your emotions as a symptom of an illness that you need to modulate or you need relief from. It changes the way an individual will cope and live.
I think this is a good note to end on. And let's do this again sometime.
Yeah, it was great. Maybe you could come on to my podcast and be a guest if you'd be willing.
I'd love it. I'd be honored. And great. Yeah, I was going to plug that again here at the end. It's called Radically Genuine. So you expect it probably by the time this is published, it'll be out, because we've got a few in the backlog. So we'll probably publish this in mid-July, early July.
Yeah, so, we're just waiting for it to be on Apple. It's okay. On Spotify right now. It's on Google. We're waiting for
it. Oh, it's already there. All right. Nice. So yeah, I hope people check this out. And I always turn attention back to the listeners and watchers at the end of the conversation, because those people who are here now listening to the end are exactly kind of who this is for. The people who want these long form conversations. I do my best to bring on high quality guests, and you certainly fit the theme, Roger. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time. Fascinating conversation.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Well, let's do it again. Take care. Have a great day.
Great meeting you.
You too.